That was a very interesting talk. It says that gene therapy is simple, easy to do. Well, I'd like to walk you through a practical example of those of us who are now trying to implement that in additional diseases. As Gene Bennett has just pointed out in a slide showing the numbers of monogenic eye diseases, there are some 600 or 700 monogenic eye diseases. Taken one at a time, that's going to take quite a while, and so Denise Dalcara has other ideas on how to do this, and Don Zak in a moment will have still further ideas on how to universalize treatments for retinal dystrophies. But I'm back trying to do disease number two, or perhaps it's number 10. Currently, there are about 10 conditions that are being discussed for gene therapy. So what I'd like to show you for the next few minutes is considerations on picking a disease suitable to do gene therapy with. My deep feeling is that one has to understand the pathology of these diseases in order to intervene successfully. One also wants to consider the window of opportunity, the time window of opportunity. That is an idea that has come up several times. And what I'm going to show you in this particular condition is the possibility of restoring vision by reactivating function. So let me start right back at the beginning, not far from here, in Austria. 1898, a physician saw two brothers with a macular dystrophy and made a very astute drawing. It's remarkable what you can do without a camera. Now, with a camera, one can see replication of this disease in one of my patients a number of years ago. There are cavities in the macula. Looking in the periphery, not of this eye, but of other eyes with this condition, the condition is called X-linked retinoschisis. Looking in the periphery, one finds other kind of damage happening. Here is a tear from the surface of the retina. This is the remaining part of the surface that has rolled up. And throughout this, a clinician looking at this will say, the pigment epithelium or something deep in the retina is not working well. Now that we have ways of looking at the retina in living people, one likes to see on the OCT a nice ordered structure such as this on the top. But those cavities that were drawn in 1898, those cavities show up here very clearly as cavities in the macula. And I would suggest that on first pass, a number of retinal surgeons would not like to stick a needle into the subretinal space to inject the vector. Not all retinas look like this with retinoschisis, but this is a person you would not particularly like to take that approach. Over the course of time, a second feature of retinoschisis became evident, and that was that the electroretinogram is missing the B wave. Now, in the normal, one sees an initial negative response, which is generated by the photoreceptors, and then a positive going B wave response, which comes after the synapse. And so encapsulated here, one is looking at photoreceptors and bipolar cells talking to each other. And characteristic of this disease, retinoschisis, is an absence or a relative absence of the B wave. When you think about that, if the B wave is generated by bipolar cells, then perhaps the bipolar cells are not functioning properly. The generator is not working. Or is it possible that the synapse that lies between the rods and the bipolar cells is not working? Several years ago, we did the required event in order to study this disease in an animal, and that is to make the to knock out the gene in a mouse and make the retinoschisis knockout mouse. We did so by inserting the neomycin cassette in place of exon 1, and that eliminated protein production, retinoschisin protein. Here in the wild-type mouse, one sees it in the rods and in the synapse particularly, and this animal does not have that protein. One also sees that there is disruption of the retinal layers, so there is a structural correlate in the mouse of this problem. In addition, compared to the normal animal, a normal mouse with the A wave and the B wave, this animal is lacking a B wave. Consequently, this animal appears to have, at least on first pass, appears to have the two features that we would like to study, the structural problem and the functional problem. Now, I would like to show you some biology so that we can understand this disease better, some biology of the areas of the retina that are expressing the protein. Here you see retinoschisin in the rod inner segment zone, not the outer segment zone. And the protein is also represented in the synaptic zone between the rod photoreceptors and the second order neurons, principally the bipolar cells. So let's look at these two regions. Here is the protein on immunogold EM. This is the inner segment of a rod, a mouse rod. This is the outer segment of a mouse rod. And the protein localizes to the inner segment region, not the outer segment region. This is a displaced inner segment, so this is one inner segment and a second inner segment, and it does not spill over onto the outer segment. At higher view, this is one inner segment and a neighbor inner segment. And you can see in the cleft between the two cells that there is copious protein. There is so much protein that one thinks that this should be doing something. But we have looked very carefully with the tools that we know about, functional tools that we know about, and we have not really seen anything missing in the knockout mouse. When we remove this protein, we do not understand what the protein should be doing. So we have now taken the tack of looking at the protein itself. This is work that just came out. This is cryo-EM imaging, and here in averages of 300 images, you can begin to see a sandwich or a star. Here is the star, here is the sandwich. The global size of this macromolecule is about 15 nanometers. And the molecule assembles with 8 retinoschisin protein connected together. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And then on top of those 8 is a second 8, and somehow they are joined together. Higher images, here at about 4 to 5 angstrom resolution, shows the 8 retinoschisin molecules, and underneath that is a second set of 8 molecules, protein. And here is the connection between those two top and bottom layers. There's also something puzzling, and that is that the RS domain, the name of the molecule, the RS domain, which is encoded by amino acids 24 to 63, you can remove that domain and the double octameric ring still persists. So we don't know what this protein is doing in the rod inner segment, and our strategy at the moment is to map out the charges on the surfaces that face the membranes. Here would be one inner segment, and here is a second inner segment, and this protein is sitting between those two rod inner segment structures. One thing that is evident is that the histidine at 207 is part of the attachment that holds these biplanar molecules together. So I hope that soon we will have a better idea of what this protein macromolecule is coordinating at the surface of the rod inner segment. There is a second location for the protein, and that is in the synapse. The synapse between the rod and the bipolar cell. Here, immunogold EM, the synaptic ribbon, so this is the presynaptic rod side. Here are the bipolar postsynaptic dendritic tips. And there is plenty of retinoschisin protein in that zone. So we looked at that in order to understand what it was doing. Now I'd like to just show you a cartoon of the synapse. The rod synapse, the presynaptic region, the purpose of that is to release glutamate as the neurotransmitter. When we look at with markers of the presynaptic integrity, that looks okay. But on the postsynaptic side, we see a problem. Now the postsynaptic element is a sign inverting, it's a G protein coupled receptor. So it has multiple parts, three parts, the glutamate receptor, cascade signaling molecules that couple to the TRP channel. And when we look at those elements, here is the glutamate receptor and the TRP channel, the dendritic tips are present in the wild type. They are also present in the knockout, and they are in about equal number. We are concluding that the problem is not involving the glutamate receptor itself, but instead the TRP channels are quite deficient. This is on the bipolar cell. Here are the bipolar cells. And when we patch clamp the bipolar cells, we see that those cell membranes are hyperpolarized. Here is the normal resting potential, and these cells are hyperpolarized, which means that upon signal transmission from the rod to the bipolar cell, this bipolar cell does not have as much operating range and consequently will have inefficient transmission of visual signals. And just to give you the story ahead, I will not show you, but after we treat with a vector to restore the protein, this membrane potential reverts to normal. Now the third element in that synapse are the signaling cascade molecules, G-beta-5, RGS-11, G-0-alpha. Here are the dendritic tips. Certainly the protein is made, but it is not well localized to the dendritic tip. It's streaming down the dendritic stalk itself. This is in the knockout animal at 90 days of age. Other animals we first treated. We treated at 4 weeks of age with the clinical vector that we are using. And when we looked 10 weeks later, we see that the proteins are in proper position. So between restoring TRP channels upon treating and restoring the proper localization of the signaling cascade molecules, the membrane potential reverts to normal. In other words, the function is recovered. So by restoring these elements, the signaling proceeds and the problem is, in one sense, fixed in the mouse. Now, just for point of reference, what this does for retinoschisis, shown at the top, X-linked retinoschisis, is to put it in the category of the congenital stationary night blind models, of which there are multiple. All of these are elements of postsynaptic dendritic and some, I think they're all postsynaptic, abnormalities that are found in human and also found in mouse CSNB models. So X-linked retinoschisis is a synaptic condition in addition to the cavities that are formed. So let's anticipate what we will be looking for in a clinical trial. One of the things that we will be looking for is synaptic function. And fortunately, I believe that we are able to see that in recording the human electroretinogram. Recall that the A wave derives from photoreceptor activity and the B wave derives from bipolar activity, and the ratio of these two gives insight into synaptic function, but only if you assume that the rods are functioning properly and the integrity of the bipolar cells remains intact. Indeed, when we use our clinical vector, we can see a recovery of the B wave in this animal. This is one animal in the treated eye and the second eye untreated. That untreated eye has cavities. Those cavities are closed by this vector that provides the protein. And at the same time, apparently the synapse is restored, and we have single unit recordings that confirm this on the cellular level. So in a clinical trial, one would have two measures of protein expression and ultimately success. It would be a structural measure and a functional measure. Now the clinical vector that we have, rather straightforward, it's an AAV serotype 8. We're delivering a human retinoschisin cDNA, and we're using the native human RS promoter with an IRBP enhancer. It's optimized in several ways, self-complementary. There's a question, and I'm sure if I took a vote of hands in the audience, there would be hands on both sides. Some believe that making the vectors self-complementary increases the efficiency. Others say it does not, it simply speeds up the rate at which expression occurs. Perhaps that's tissue or cell specific. This vector was made ultimately by Fraser Wright at Children's Hospital, Philadelphia. Now, I want to emphasize something that both Denise and Gene Bennett have mentioned, and that is that there are many different ways that you can approach the therapy. Every vector is going to have three parts: some delivery virus, some gene, and a promoter. Well, the gene is relatively fixed, although there are ways that you can shorten the cDNA. But the promoter and the virus are open game. Do you want AAV2? Do you want AAV9, 5, 8? We chose 8. The promoter, you could use an ubiquitous promoter that expresses in every cell type, or you could, as we did, use a promoter that is targeted to the native cells that normally express retinoschisin protein. We chose the RS promoter. Or as Gene said, maybe that's not the right way to do it because the experiment was tried in the RP65 approach, and compared to an ubiquitous chicken beta actin promoter, a stronger promoter in that case, there seemed to have been better human expression with a CBA promoter. So we'll have to find out. But what this means in a very practical sense is that when people say there were three RPE65 trials that were done, maybe that's a waste. In fact, each of those trials was quite independent, quite separate, and quite necessary. What about delivering the vector? Today, thus far, we have heard about putting the vector in the subretinal space, which elevates a region of the retina, delivers high levels of vector by direct contact. But it does have some difficulties in delivery, and particularly in this condition, where there are cysts and cavities, you might want to think instead of finding a way to deliver into the vitreous cavity. Easier to administer, it reaches the entire retina, as I'll show you in a moment, but it does risk ocular inflammation, and ultimately it also risks disabling the vector because of immune exposure. But that is the approach that we have taken, a single intravitreal injection. Two examples. Here you can see the eye cup, a mouse, very small. The vector we are putting into the vitreous cavity, and it is reaching into the rod inner segments across the entirety of the retina. Or at higher resolution, the same vector, EGFP, CMV, different construct, also injected into the vitreous. It penetrates the retina and gets to the rods. When we started doing this, there was very little known about what an appropriate delivery would be. And so we proceeded by simply putting the vector into the vitreous. Now it is known, and in this case, we can demonstrate our vector, either AV8, CMV, EGFP, or the clinical vector, when we do this same administration in a wild-type mouse, it does not work. It does not penetrate, as also Denise Zalcara has explained. So there is something in the mouse RS disease that allows the penetration, and the first bet that we are making, The first question we have is whether the human disease also is permissive for this vector to enter the retina. So we have an interesting disease target. We certainly have a window of opportunity because in the adult mouse we can restore function, which is nice. We can restore vision by activating function. But the next question is, will it work in human? Mice are fun. But to try this in human and to know the answer, the only way to do that is actually to try it. So we are in the middle of a human clinical trial. I'm showing you here dosing data. This is a subset of the data that we took to the FDA for regulatory approvals to proceed with human trial. Levels of expression by dose, function by dose, and cavity by dose. The expression, 1E7, 1E8, 2E9, you can see that at low levels of dosing there is no expression, and it then increases dramatically over the course of one log unit. There is some threshold evident. And so at 1E8, there is expression. And interestingly, importantly, at 1E8, there is also restoration of function. No function, restoration of function. No structural effect, closure of the cavities. So we know the dose in mouse, but then as Jean has already said, one has to scale this by the 100 or 1,000-fold levels in order to scale this to the human ocular size. And we have done that. These are scaled by rod cell number, by retinal surface area, or by retinal volume, vitreous volume. And we started this trial a year and a half ago. We have dosed a number of these people. And we are now looking at the data to make some sense out of it. The outcomes, well, I've explained that retinal structure and retinal function would be two outcomes. Retinal function, we would hope that ERG response or improving synaptic function will ultimately translate into an acuity improvement because that is the easiest route to FDA regulatory approvals. When you start looking at the clinical patients, there is another window of opportunity, at least for this condition, and that is by age, here, 20 years old, 40 years old, 60, and 80 years old. The retina at young age is abnormally thick because of those cavities. But by age 50, the cavities collapse. There is some natural history, some evolution of the disease. And one would think that this is not the optimal window in time to be treating. So there are two windows that we need to be aware of. One is, when can we restore that synaptic function? And in the mouse, we can do it in adult mice at 6 months of age. But in human, there is in fact a loss of photoreceptors, very slow, but there is structural loss of photoreceptors, and one wants to treat earlier than this. And then in preparation for the trial, we also looked at the repeatability of clinical parameters in these subjects with retinaschisis, acuity, ERG, sensitivities, and OCT thickness. We looked at that on both sides, better or worse, over time, in order to get a sense of what the natural history and the test fluctuation is. So that's the end of the talk. I hope that very soon I will have some interesting news coming out of the clinical trial that we are currently running in human. And I think this kind of story would best be replicated in many of the diseases before putting them to a gene therapy trial. Each disease has its own flavor, its own clinical course, its own characteristics, its own disease population. It has its own structural issues and functional issues. And in order to really mount a useful clinical trial, I think understanding the dynamics of the pathology is going to be important. So with that, thank you, and professors, all thank you for a very interesting day. Thank you.